In the council, we are a little early, but we're only going to be hearing arguments from you. Or do you have anybody that will be joining us as well? And if so, are they here or not?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe anyone else will be joining. There may be some people from my office observing, but we can start before they get
Okay.
here. They're not here
Okay.
yet.
Why don't we go ahead and get started then? Today is Wednesday, February 19th, 2025. This is the third of three cases we have set for oral argument. There is no, and by the way, this is being held via Zoom, and we will have a recording, an audio recording available after the oral arguments today within the next day or two. However, no other recordings are permitted of this proceeding. We did not receive a brief from respondent, so we will only be hearing from one party today. You will have 15 minutes. You won't have time to rebut yourself. So make sure you use those 15 minutes as well as you can. When you begin, please state your name for the record and the party you are representing, and you may proceed.
Thank you, and may it please the court. My name is Jessica Fonts. I am a staff attorney with Legal Services of Northwest Minnesota, and I represent the appellant Janice Teets in this matter. And broadly speaking, the issue in this case is whether the district court abused its discretion when finding that the appellant's actions met the standard for harassment under Minnesota Statute 609-748 and relevant case law. And it is our position that the district court did abuse its discretion by making findings of fact that were unsupported by evidence in the record, by misapplying the law to those findings, and by resolving the case in a manner that was contrary to logic and facts on the record. In addition, this is really a situation where the appellant, who was the victim of domestic abuse by the respondent and had an order for protection against him, took reasonable steps to protect herself and secure her property, and was then penalized by the district court for doing so through this harassment restraining order. And the law in Minnesota does not and should not allow for this outcome. The way I've decided to structure my argument here is by framing it based on the explicit findings that the district court made when granting the HRO, but I do understand that this court may also consider implicit findings of fact. So, if any of your honors have questions or would like me to discuss any implicit findings that could have been made by the district court in this case based on the record, I'm more than happy to do so. In order for the harassment restraining order in this case to have been properly granted, the district court would have had to find that the appellant had engaged in repeated incidents of intrusive or unwanted acts, words, or gestures that had or were intended to have a substantial adverse effect on the respondent's safety, security, or privacy. And the first issue that I'll discuss is the district court's finding that the appellant damaged the respondent's property by screwing a door closed, changing the locks, and going through his belongings. First, this finding is not supported by the record because there was no evidence presented that any property was damaged. The respondent did not allege damage to any property. He did not testify to damage, and he did not present any other evidence of damage.
Well,
And I
counsel, isn't really the issue of whether or not whether or not there really was more an invasion of privacy, because the OFP stated that he had to stay 100 feet distant from the house, but it explicitly said that it does not extend to the shop, which has a separate address. So that shop was not part of the property. So why is it that there was a separate property? So why doesn't that mean, I mean, it's separate. So
Yes, Your Honor. And I think the timing here is really important to that question because the respondent testified at the OF or at the HRO hearing that he discovered that the door had been screwed shut and the locks had been changed and that the appellant had gone through his belongings. When he returned home from the hospital, he testified that she did this while he was in the hospital. And he was discharged from the hospital on May 29th, 2024, which is the same day that the order for protection, the ex parte order for protection, was granted against him. And the ex parte order for protection did not allow him to access the garage. So it wasn't until the OFP hearing on June 10th that the OFP was modified to allow him to access the garage. But between May 29th and June 10th, he had to stay 100 feet from the residence at 19 Grand Avenue, and this extended to the garage at 23 Grand Avenue. So he didn't have any legal right to access the garage at the time that the appellant in this case took the property-related actions that the court deemed were harassment.
So Ms. Fonts, I understood the record to be that the ex parte OFP only applied to the address of the residence, not to the address of the garage, and also that there was a dispute in the evidence that the court resolved in favor of the respondent that in any event, it was more than 100 feet away from the house. So it doesn't seem the record supports what you just told me here, unless I'm reading the record wrong.
And Your Honor, my reading of the record, there was a dispute over how far away the garage was from the house. However, in the ex parte order, it did not explicitly exclude the garage from the 100 feet requirement. And in the order for protection that was issued after the hearing on June 10th, it did say that the 100 foot radius does not extend or does not include the garage. So my reading of that, and my position is the court would not have had to make that explicit exception to the 100 foot radius rule if the garage was in fact more than 100 feet from the house.
Well, but the ex parte OFP only listed the address of the house, and the garage had a separate address, did it not?
That's correct, Your Honor. And I would just note again, the ex parte OFP said that he must stay 100 feet from the address listed, which was the house, and that 100 feet included the garage, which was two lots down essentially from the house, and then was modified at the hearing to exclude that.
So the lot was, or I'm sorry, the shop or garage was two lots down, but that was still within 100 feet. That's
Yes, Your Honor, this is a
continued
mobile
use.
home park, so the lots are quite small, and the appellant and respondent own the house that's at 20 or at 19, and they rent the two lots adjacent to it. So the middle lot the appellant uses it as a garden, and then the far lot is where the garage sits. So they rent all three lots, but they are quite close together.
Well, but the district court heard evidence that they were over 150 feet and apparently accepted that in clarifying its order that the garage was not part of the distance restriction, right?
And Your Honor, just for clarification, do you mean the district court in this case, in the harassment restraining order case, or that heard the order for protection case?
Well, I think it could be either because. If the lot, if the garage, the shop had a different address that wasn't included in the original OFP, I'm not sure how the OFP would apply to it in any event.
And my position is that because the OFP that was issued after the hearing explicitly stated that the 100 feet does not extend to the garage, that shows that the garage is within 100 feet of the house, and it is be there's an exception being made to this 100 foot radius requirement to allow the respondent to access the garage.
So that's an inference you're making from the language in the OFP?
Yes, Your Honor.
How is that supported by the record, though?
It's the record in this case. We do, I mean, there is testimony about how far away that the garage is from the house. And I do, I mean, it's true that the respondent testified that it was more than 100 feet, 150 feet. However, the appellant testified that it was less than 100 feet. I mean, the way that I am reading it, viewed either way, is that there would not be a need to state that the 100 feet radius in the OFP does not include the garage if the garage was in fact more than 100 feet from the house, because then it really wouldn't make a difference one way or the other of whether the respondent is allowed to access the garage, because he would still be in compliance with the order for protection terms if the garage is more than 100 feet from the house.
Well, it isn't it another reasonable interpretation to say that the garage was specifically separated out, because oftentimes when you think of a house, you think of if there's a garage related to it, and both of the parties had used both the house and the garage, and just to make clear that no, the garage is separate. That's where he works. That's where he runs his business. So he can, that is something that he can go to. It's not part of the residence per se.
Yes, Your Honor, I think that is an inference that could be made, that the court in the OFP after the hearing wanted to make it just very clear and explicit that the garage is not included in the order for protection. However, at the time that this occurred, which was on May 29th, that final OFP order had not yet been issued, and so the respondent was not allowed to access the garage at that time based on the ex parte order. And that I don't know if it is part of the testimony or if the testimony got into it, but the sheriff did prevent the respondent from accessing the garage until after the June 10th order. And I understand that doesn't necessarily mean that the order was interpreted up until that June 10th hearing. So it was my client's position that he was not allowed to access the garage, and it was her understanding based on the ex parte order, and she took reasonable steps to secure her property and her own safety because she anticipated that the respondent would attempt to access the garage, as well as potentially the house. So she was taking steps that she believed reasonably were in accordance with the order for protection terms. And that, in my view, would not and could not be the basis of a harassment restraining order against her because she was complying with a court order that had just recently been issued. I would also like to add that the district court's order granting the harassment restraining order on this basis poses a fairly significant public policy concern. And I did get into this a little bit, but really what happened here was that on May 29th, a district court judge found that the appellant had been the victim of physical domestic abuse by the respondent and granted that ex parte order in her favor. And the appellant was aware that the respondent would be returning home from the hospital. And like I said, she took steps to secure her own safety and her property. And I think if the court were to find that this type of action constitutes or rises to the level of harassment, it could raise significant concerns for somebody who takes reasonable and prudent steps to protect themselves, especially while they are preparing to leave abusive relationships, which, as I hope this court is aware, is the most dangerous time for people who are in relationships that involve domestic violence. I would also like to discuss the threats, or the district court's finding that the appellant had threatened the respondent by calling the sheriff's office and reporting that he had violated the order for protection. The district court found that he, or the district court based this finding on the appellant having called to report the respondent for being in the garage, but this is actually not supported by the record. The respondent did not testify or include in his petition that the sheriff call was to report him for being in the garage. Rather, he testified that the appellant had reported him for violating the order for protection. And the circumstances of this possible OFP violation are a bit unclear from the record. There isn't anything in the record about what the respondent was allegedly doing that caused the appellant to believe he was in violation of the order for protection. But even setting that aside, the district court's findings are not supported by the record. Or rather, the district court misapplied the law to those findings that I still believe were unsupported by the record. And this is on Peterson versus Johnson, which requires that if a district court is making findings that a call to law enforcement is harassment, it must also make specific findings that the caller's intent was improper. Specifically, the district court must find that the caller knew that the person they were reporting was not breaking the law and that the call was for the sole purpose of harassing them. And no such findings were made in this case. And just very briefly, my last point is the district court's final reasoning for the HRO was based on evidence that the appellant had entered the garage. And again, this is really just a blatant misapplication of law to the facts. The appellant entering the garage did not and was not intended to have an adverse effect on the respondent's safety, security, or privacy. She did not go into the garage while the respondent was present. She testified that when the respondent was in the garage, she would stay inside her home because she felt scared to death of him. And she didn't do anything that could compromise his safety or security while she was in the garage. And in addition, the garage is marital property as well, and she had the legal right to access it. And I recognize my time is up, so I will end there. But thank you so much for your time this morning, Your Honors. And if there are any additional questions, I'm happy to answer them.
I don't see any further questions. So thank you very much for your arguments and your presentation and your briefing. We appreciate it. We'll be issuing an opinion within the 90-day statutory timeframe. And that is our last case for our calendar for today. So the court is now in recess. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to exit the meeting. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay.